Hi, how are you? Thanks for tuning in. I want to welcome you to the pod. This is The Benefit of the Doubt, a podcast about politics and culture with Quentin and Thane, in which two friends push each other to think, learn, and grow while discussing some of the most important and contentious topics of the day. Stay tuned for hot takes, plenty of mistakes, and the occasional moment of brilliance. And with that, let's get to it. Quentin, how's it going?
What's going on, brother?
Hey, man. So we're talking about family today, and that's the highest level way I could put it. This was a topic that you were interested in talking about, and I'd love just to start by hearing where that came from for you and what more specifically has been on your mind.
Absolutely. So I was invited to be a part of a little conference last week. And it was hosted by this group called the American Enterprise Institute. And they're a think tank out in Washington, D.C. And I think they're largely conservative leaning. I think they own that. I think their opponents are happy to slap that label on them. But if you look at their research and their scholars, they're certainly not ideologues. They're certainly not partisan. And I think there's a lot of really interesting thinking coming out of there. They're founded by, I think, a guy who you and I look up to a lot named Arthur C. Brooks, who is, I think, one of the best people in the country at telling the story of conservatism in a way that is compelling for all kinds of Americans. You know, and when they asked me if I wanted to be part of this, I said, look, you know, I generally identify as a progressive, and I hope there's a diversity of viewpoints within the group that you're inviting to this conversation. And they said, yeah, yeah. And so I went. The conversation that I found most triggering, maybe, and thought-provoking was about family. And the basic thrust of the conversation was these two speakers, one was a Black man, the other was a white woman, were talking about this recent report that had come out from the UK, from Britain. And effectively, you know, the UK has been going through the same kind of reckoning or a similar kind of reckoning that we are going through here in the United States related to race. And so Boris Johnson created this commission to investigate racial disparities in Britain to try to figure out what's going on here. So he created a 10-person panel, 9 of which are folks of color. And they engaged in an exhaustive analysis of the different dimensions of UK society. And then they published their report. And the results were, suffice it to say, divisive, because they did not come out and say that the primary reason for racial disparities in the UK is injustice that's built into the structures of society. Instead, one of the primary things that they pointed to was the family. And here's a quote from the executive summary of the report. They said, "In many areas of investigation, including educational failure and crime, we were led upstream to family breakdown as one of the main reasons for poor outcomes. Family is also the foundation stone of success for many ethnic minorities," end quote. And so, as you might imagine, this is a way of thinking about race that is not common in American conversations, especially not the ones that are mainstream today. And it hasn't been very popular at all in the UK as well. A lot of these people who were part of this report have been facing intense criticism since they published it. And I think, you know, we don't live in Britain, and so I don't know if we want to take on the details of the report as such, but let's at least today take on the question that they are suggesting in the report, which is, what role do we think family and family structure plays in providing opportunity here in the United States? What role does family play in the kind of opportunity that's available for American kids? I think it's a pretty fascinating question. I think it's one that is kind of novel. It feels a little dangerous, but I think we can take it on. So that's kind of the framing. And And you said this is something that you have deep feelings about. So I'd love to know, when I suggested the topic and I framed it here a little bit, what are some of your initial thoughts on this theme?
The timing is a bit coincidental. I happen to be slowly sort of listening my way through a book called The Boy Crisis. And The Boy Crisis is a book partly about boys, but as much about fathers as it is about boys. And a lot of the data that I have been exposed to in that just hammers home a point that corroborates what the UK report seems to say, which is just that when you pull a father out of a household, it's terrible. It's a terrible thing for the children in the household. It's obviously, it can be destabilizing financially, but there's actually so much more. And in many ways, we don't necessarily pay enough attention to the role that fathers have in the development of their children, from by some of the research in the book, not just in their later years, but from day one, there are improved outcomes from children who spend time at 6 months, like just in the hands of their fathers. So that's one lens on it that goes to the point. But the outcomes of these are, the numbers are really, really remarkable. And what I was struck in the book by is that some of these, that the delta on intact family versus broken family, or a family without a father, or a family without one of the parents, they're so substantial that you would, if you knew the numbers, you'd be surprised that we don't talk about it more. I think that was kind of like a high level takeaway that I had from this other book. So mm-hmm. when you brought it up, it seemed to be highlighting the same thing, that this is having such a tremendous impact on the children who are not fortunate enough to be raised in a family with both parents. And we don't talk about it all that much as a culture. And one question is why is that? Why is it? Is it because we find this problem to be so difficult and so intractable? Is it because we are afraid of saying that if it's not entirely the result of some sort of systemic injustice, then it is your fault, which is something that we don't want to do, tying the sort of the behavior to responsibility thing, which I think makes a lot of people pause. And in some cases, for good reason, if it could lead to sort of a scapegoating impulse. But the cost of that is we may not be addressing a root cause here.
I want to try to paint a picture more broadly of what's happening in the United States when it comes to family. So here's maybe three data points to help all of us have a shared starting point as we think about what's going on with family in the United States. So this is all from Pew. Thane and I love Pew. We think this is a really good source.
National
treasure. So in 1968, 85% of kids were living with married parents. And that might have been with their first marriage or their second marriage, but 85% of kids were living with married parents. And in 2017, 65% of kids were living with married parents, which means you have almost a third of American kids living in single-parent homes, or a small percentage of them living with cohabitating parents. So there's one data point. Okay, so that's broadly. The second data point, I think, is one that we have to let sink in and move us a little bit. So the different family structures are really different based on race. So 36% of Black children are living with married parents, and the rest are living either with single mothers. That's 47%, and small percentages with single dads or cohabitating parents. But just over a third of Black children are living with married parents. Compare that, or contrast that, with 75% of white kids are living with married parents. So there's incredible racial differences here. And I think it's also important to note a racial group that maybe we don't talk enough about. Hispanic kids, Latino kids, 62% of them are living with married parents. So just really interesting family dynamics here that may help us tell some of the story of the inequality in our country. And then the last one that I think is perhaps most interesting of all is Pew shared this data with Americans and asked them, does this matter, right? Does the change in family structure in the United States, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Or does it make no difference? And 75% either think it makes no difference or it's a good thing. And only 16% of Americans think it's a bad thing. So we've got changing demographics of the family. We've got a real racial disparity in terms of who is experiencing this. And we have most Americans thinking it's either a good thing or it doesn't make any difference. So Thane, make some sense of all that.
I mean, the numbers are sort of both remarkable and I think, unfortunately, you know, these are statistics that we do hear from time to time. The last one initially really struck me, the one that 75% find that it makes no difference or is a good thing. On the flip side, you know, if I think it's a natural thing, if you are a mother trying to raise a child who without the help of a husband or vice versa or whatever, that you're not in the married parent bucket and you're called by Pew, you might say it makes no difference and good on you because you got to do the best you can for your child. So I don't exactly know how much weight to put on that last one. You know, as you're talking about the racial disparities, this is an interaction between the systemic and the behavioral that I think is important to pause on. Rates of incarceration for Black men are extraordinarily high, and prison populations have jumped 700% since the 70s. Those men are not with their children, their sons and their daughters. And whatever we may think about the justice of them being in prison for whatever they may have done, it has real clear negative consequences for their families. And maybe we should think about that more.
One of the things that is a question that I'm stuck on, and I've been trying to have this conversation with folks in my life, had a great debate with my wife about it, and she had some really interesting thoughts that I might share as well. But if it is true that there's a certain kind of family structure that is better for kids than others, how do we project that kind of ideal without using it as a club to beat people over the head with? How do we have an ideal that says, hey, two parents is staying married, this is really healthy for your kid, like do it, and yet not have a society where single parents, people who decide to get a divorce, are somehow marginalized because they don't live up to the ideal? And I think that's the real challenge. It's not just a challenge in family, but it's a particular one with family. I think it's where conservatives are feeling like their voice is starting to matter less and less in the national conversation. Because I think conservatives do suggest that there is an ideal. And I don't think our culture knows how to have an ideal that doesn't become a weapon. What do you think about this?
My first response is, are we anywhere near sort of holding up that ideal right now? And is it anything approximating a club? If 75% actually thinks that this is a good way to do things or makes no difference, it seems like the conversation isn't that maybe the worry shouldn't be, is this a club and are we ostracizing people who are not meeting this ideal or building their family structures in this way? And maybe the concern is simply like, how do we model this in the culture again?
Sure. Yeah, I will tell a vaguely worded family story that anyone in my family will know exactly what this story is about, but I'll try to honor, at least in a tiny way, people's identity here. But I was in a family event recently that was celebrating the anniversary of some family members, and one of the elder family members said to all the other family members who were there, which included four generations of people this person said to everyone there, never, ever, ever get a divorce, ever. And it was really interesting because a lot of people in that reunion, this was a virtual reunion, obviously, have been divorced. But I thought about that, like, what do we think about that? Like, what do we think about having leaders within culture saying things like, divorce is bad? This is what this person who we all look up to and love was saying. But knowing that there are people who are going to hear that and like be hurt by that, like they're going to feel pain when they hear that.
Yeah.
We all know people we love who have gotten divorced for all kinds of reasons, many of them very good. That to me brought this question home of how do we have an ideal that doesn't become a club, like in a personal way.
Yeah.
I do wonder if people who are divorced, people who are living in same-sex marriages, people who are cohabitating, do you think they would say that we live in a country without an ideal? Because I my hunch is that they would say we live in a country that judges their way of life.
Hey, it's a great question. It's not one that I'm well positioned to answer. I think there is a movement in the sort of culture making institutions, from entertainment to the media, to lift up structures that don't look like the traditional American nuclear family. I like that you brought up this other example, though, that isn't, you know, it isn't what you might see on Netflix, is what you might see from someone in your family, which is sort of a different way, probably a less scalable way, but potentially a more impactful way that these ideals can be passed on if they are. We have come back to this question of ideals a few times on the pod, and I think it's such an interesting one and seems to be the question of the moment, even though I have been wrestling with this question for a couple of years now and have not been able to articulate it precisely. Maybe the best we've done so far is what you just said about how do you hold up an ideal without turning it into a club. You know, I'm stuck here because on the one hand, I think the ideal is right. I mean, I think, you know, in my worldview and in my faith, I think that marriage is a profound commitment to another person and something that should, wherever possible, remain unbroken. And yet I know that life is messy, and the older I get, the more I see that. And I see dear friends who have gone through really difficult relationships and gotten divorced, and it is so clearly the right thing to have done in those instances that it just adds, I suppose it adds texture to the ideal that means that it cannot be absolute in potentially the way that your family member was framing it.
Beyond the religious side of this, is there anything else that makes you argue that, or makes you believe that marriage should be the ideal? And maybe not just in terms of the story between two people and their love, but more broadly and socially. I don't think we've made this case yet or even tried to. Why do you think that marriage as an ideal is good for America?
Because children of married couples tend to do better on average than children of single parent homes. And the magnitude of that difference is actually really substantial. So, you know, Quentin and I, we don't approach these topics as policy experts, but this actually appears to be an area where there is some consensus. And with the caveat that these are statistics and they describe the situation on average, there are children who have tremendous lives despite not being raised in the context of a marriage, and certainly not all intact married families are a good place to raise a child. But having said that, when compared with the children of married couples, children of single parent homes are more than twice as likely to be arrested for a juvenile crime, twice as likely to be treated for emotional and behavioral problems, roughly twice as likely to be suspended or expelled from school, and a third more likely to drop out before completing high school. and it doesn't get better after school years. Those same children are three times more likely to end up in jail by the time they reach 30. And girls from single parent homes are more than twice as likely to have a child without being married, which repeats the cycle. Most of those are from the Journal of Marriage and Family, which Google Scholar tells me is the top journal for family studies. It's worth pointing out that there is some more recent research in the last couple of years that has looked at how big the gap is between these two groups of children and compared that gap between racial groups, and has found that the gap between single parent homes and children of married couples is smaller in Black and Hispanic households. And that might be interesting when we think of social policy. The hypothesis is that the underlying socioeconomic conditions are the starting point is worse in Black and Hispanic households. So the effect of the family arrangement is just lower relative to the starting point. But still, even in those households, the premise holds and the trend holds. It's just worse for kids to be raised in a single parent home. And that doesn't necessarily say anything about the efforts of that single parent, but it just seems pretty clear that two is better than one. So to me, that these are pretty stunning numbers for their magnitude, and something that we should take really seriously, because these are the lives of kids that are really at stake, and they seem to do better in married homes. So that's, to me, that's maybe the most compelling argument that we could make.
Yeah. Well, hey, you did the hard part there of trying to ground this in data outside of you and I just telling stories. I do want to tell a couple anecdotes that may fit into that data. So, you know, I was sharing that for 5 years, I was a teacher at an all boys school. And the first thing I would say as I reflect on the boys and their behavior is that the best indicator anecdotally of which kids were going to be or were struggling the most in class was often family. And if there was a kid who was really struggling, finding out that his parents were getting divorced, that his mom was raising him and his brothers and sisters on her own, that he was maybe living with his grandparents, that was never a surprise. It sort of became something that I expected, honestly. It seemed like a routinely occurring thing that the kids who were most struggling academically or the kids who were just a pain in class had something going on in their family. So I guess I would summarize that by saying, like, watching these kids at a particular developmental moment of their lives, family was shaping them in real time, and it was very easy to see as an observer and as someone who cared about these kids.
What, if anything, does the school sort of do with that data point that there seems to be a connection between trouble at home in the family and the extent to which students are thriving at school?
I think that the school tries to take a holistic approach to kids. I know this especially happens at the middle school level, where they really wrap their arms around those kids that they bring into the middle school, which is just for kids who qualify for free and reduced lunch. And I know that they just take a really intentional approach of understanding family dynamics and letting that inform how they discipline kids, what kind of latitude they give to kids. I think the generosity of spirit for kids. I mean, I know for me as a teacher, like on an individual level, I can think of one student in particular who I hated seeing the student. And not because I hated him, but because he made me feel like I was a terrible teacher. And I could tell that I made him feel like he was a terrible student. And that's, no one enjoys those moments. And then I found out that, you know, he was living with his grandmother and hadn't seen his dad in however many years, and his mom was really struggling. And it didn't change our relationship. Like, we didn't necessarily go from having a lot of tension in the classroom to just all of a sudden being buddies, but it really helped me as his teacher, I think, have a sense of generosity towards him and understanding, because I think intuitively we all get this, right? And it's hard to talk about at the social and the policy level, but on the individual level, I think we all understand that if we have a child in front of us who comes from a family that isn't a two-parent home, for whatever reason that might be, that child may be carrying with them trauma and maybe reacting and responding to things in a way that's outside of their control. But then when we take that understanding and we try to think about what that looks like policy-wise, what that looks like in terms of the ideals that we promote in our country, we get tongue-tied.
Yeah. Yeah. Quentin, before we maybe go down the policy direction, is there anything about your experience that you like to sort of share in this conversation as we talk about the experience of children who were not raised by their birth parents?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I will never forget my first experiences of learning about white privilege when I was in college. And my first experiences, and maybe this is common, and maybe this is to be expected from those of you who are versed in this world, but my first like reaction was, you don't understand. Like, that was my first response, because we did this privilege walk when I was in college. And I ended up at this certain level of being at kind of the most privileged based on this series of questions about race and identity and socioeconomic status. And the point of it was to show how much my own journey had been privileged. And it felt so foreign to me, because I feel like I've sort of been spending my whole life trying to heal from this particular wound. And there's no perpetrators to a wound of like adoption, I don't think, at least not in my story. Like, I was adopted through my family, and I think everyone who was a part of that story had my best interest at heart. And I am the person I am because I was surrounded by so much love. And I also know that it is a lifetime journey to heal from that, and to feel a sense of worthiness and belonging. And those things don't come naturally to me. Those are things I've had to learn. Those are things I've had to teach myself. You know, therapy is something that has been a part of my life more or less my entire life. And so in one sense, I think my story is one of that family structure is not destiny. Mm. And so you said this at the beginning, like, someone can come from a challenging family structure and still thrive. But even me, who I think had such a blessed experience to come into a really stable family at age 4. It was two parents. They took family very seriously, and I think passed that on to me. Even still, like, the trauma of being a kid and having the world around you be unstable is, I just feel like I know it intimately. Mm. And still know it as a 31-year-old intimately. So I do think that I don't know if it pushes me in any particular direction policy-wise, but it certainly does just raise the stakes, because like, whatever kinds of family structures and family lives we are able to support in the United States, like, that will have the direct impact on kids, and that will shape the kinds of adults that they become, I think. So I don't know if I was very articulate there. I just think, like, yeah, it really matters.
Yeah. No, you were very articulate, and thank you for sharing that with me, sure, and with our many listeners. Do you remember whether they asked in that privilege walk whether you were raised by your birth parents or in a house with two parents or were divorced or that that particular thread? And I'll get to why in a second, but.
The honest answer is I don't remember, but they couldn't have asked it many ways because I really did find myself on one extreme of the privilege walk at the end.
The reason I ask is because my, it almost does. I mean, to some degree, it doesn't matter what the answer is. Either they didn't ask it, which would betray just, I think, a blind spot in assessing all of the environmental factors that help children be successful. And, you know, I think you and I are both happy to acknowledge that, I certainly speak for myself, and I think you too, but privilege is a real thing, and it is something that that I have been very blessed with. What exactly we do with that as a culture is a different question, but that particular type of privilege would either be not addressed or be one amongst many others when we look at a lot of data that suggests that one variable has a tremendous impact on the opportunities that children have to grow in a safe and secure household. That I think leads us to ask like why is that? Is it because there's sort of just a dissenting view that is ascendant in how we think about that particular issue from an empirical standpoint? Is there some other reason why it's a blind spot? This might be a segue into policy, but I continue to be struck by that question, that why aren't we talking about this more?
I don't know. It's a really good question. I will say that I wonder if we are in general allergic to hierarchies.
Mm.
And this was actually some of the pushback that I got in this conversation during this conference from a Black man who leads an institute that is about promoting Black fatherhood. And I was in our chat talking about, hey, like, you know, why don't we allow for an evolving sense of the family structure and an ideal that can make room for all different kinds of families. I actually do believe that. And maybe if you want, you might want to push me on that a little bit, because that's something I feel strongly about. But he came at me, he said, like, you have to accept there is a hierarchy of family and that there are certain families that are better than others. And there are certain family structures that are better than others. And then some single moms chimed in and said, I'm starting to feel like I don't have a role in this conversation, which I thought, again, was a really fascinating point. But let's take the question of hierarchy. Like, I think in culture, we are so committed to inclusivity that we don't allow for hierarchies. And when I say hierarchies, I mean saying, here are seven different possibilities of this pattern of life. Let's say family. Here's seven different ways your life could go when it comes to family. Married, you know, divorced and remarried, divorced, single parent, never married, whatever it might be, and how you raise kids. Can we say that one of those is the best? This guy was saying, yes, we need to have a hierarchy. I think culturally we are allergic to that.
I mean, I think that's a fascinating observation. Can you maybe, like, if you were to state as forcefully as you could the argument against that sort of hierarchical thinking, do you have a sense for what that might be?
I would say two things. So the first, I would say, if you have a hierarchy that is too rigid, I think there is shame that comes from being outside of that hierarchy or being on the lower steps of it, right? I just think there's shame if you're a single parent, for example. I also think that in general, it can be, this is stepping a little outside of family. I think family is next to sexuality and sexual orientation. I think they're right next, they're next door neighbors, these themes. I think people are harmed when they are forced into specific gender and family norms that can apply to folks who are, you know, gay, for example. Like, this conversation hasn't talked at all about straight versus gay, but I would imagine that most people who believe that there is a hierarchy of family, and I'm not saying this is you, but I would say that I think a lot of people I was talking with this past week believe this. If they believe there is a hierarchy when it comes to family, they also believe that that hierarchy is not just any two parents, but a mother and a father, right? As opposed to two moms or two dads. And I think that can bring harm if we have a hierarchy that people don't fit into, and there's shame and exclusion because of that. I think that's one. And then the second, and this is something that my wife brought up, and I think she's right, is that sometimes hierarchies can keep can perpetuate a greater harm. So we were having this debate over dinner about this theme, and I was saying, you know, I actually kind of compelled by this idea of having an ideal family structure. And she said, well, if you promote marriage so heavily, and there is a husband who's beating his wife, like, what recourse does that woman have to exit that marriage if socially there is so much pressure around her to stay in it for the good of the child? It may actually be much better for the child to leave that marriage. And so I just think, like, the complexities of life that don't fit neatly into hierarchies would be another pushback against this. So what do you think? Are those convincing to you, or are they not?
Taking the second one first, I think it's a totally reasonable point to make. I just don't think we're anywhere near that world. Mm. It does not seem that strictures on divorce is a real problem in the United States. I'm not going to quote you the latest number on divorce rates, but it's certainly not a rare event. So if we're looking at an ideal relative to where we are today, that's not something that I worry about as a generality. In a particular instance, in a particular community, maybe. I want to double back. When you talk about harm, that holding up an ideal of any sort could cause harm to another group that doesn't fit the ideal via shame or some feeling of exclusion, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? And who is it that is being harmed?
So, well, let's just go to the church, right? I mean, let's go to the church. So I'll try to answer your question, because this is me trying to tell other people's stories. And I think it's a good question to ask other people. But I look at the way that the Catholic Church will make people who are divorced often feel pretty unwelcome, right? Even to the extent that in certain churches, people who are divorced and remarried are not welcome to receive the Eucharist. That is one cultural data point. I think also it probably goes without saying that in certain churches, two men who are married are not welcome to receive the Eucharist. Now, I'm crisscrossing here from maybe a conversation about American policy into the Catholic Church, but we can imagine those same kinds of feeling on the outside of society if we had such a strong cultural norm around marriage that people who didn't fit into that type felt emotionally and sometimes quite literally, if you think about the ways in which there are certain rights that are ascribed to married people that are not given to people who are not married. I just think there's harm there. I know I didn't answer your question, but I sort of feel like I already answered it. So I feel like I'm repeating myself. I mean, I'm happy to get into, I don't feel like very educated in this, but we would agree that there is a level of harm that comes from your life being considered abnormal socially, religiously, when it comes to the certain benefits that are offered at the governmental level. I mean, I just think that feels to me kind of self-evident.
Yeah, I mean, I hear two things. I hear I hear a certain level of social stigma. And then in certain instances, financial resources that are not available, or tax benefits that are not available to unmarried couples. When we think about harm, though, if we were talking about the question of raising children, it seems to me like you also have to consider the outcomes to the child. So it sort of becomes this, I don't know if wanes the right word, but if indeed it is better for children on average to be raised in a home with two birth parents, how much weight are we willing to give that relative to the sort of harms that you've outlined on that might arise from holding up this sort of hierarchy of families? In some senses, I think that seems to be one of the core questions here that we and our sort of country are grappling with when we think about this.
Let's say there's data that shows that a child who's raised in a family with a mom and a dad is going to have X better outcomes than a child that's raised by two moms. So what does that tell us? Does that tell us something about the kinds of marriages that we should promote in society? Or does it tell us that maybe our society is just set up in such a way that it's just way easier for husbands and wives to navigate than same-sex couples? I think that's an interesting question, right? I think maybe the answer there is that actually we need to change the way that socially we embrace and make room for other family structures, rather than saying, well, clearly this family structure is better than that one. The same can be said for a different way of thinking about family structure, which is, let's say that there's data that shows that a kid is better off in a home where one parent stays at home. Let's say specifically that data shows that the kid is better if a mom stays at home and a dad works. And a kid is worse off if both parents are working, or the dad stays at home and the mom works. Again, one outcome there is that there's actually a better family structure and we should promote it. And it's this very traditional one. Another possibility is that, again, our society is not set up in such a way to really help families with two working parents thrive, or to really help parents or families where the mom works and the dad stays at home thrive. So I guess that would be my response to your point about focusing on the impact of the child or to the child, because I would worry that if we react too quickly to that, we could really ostracize a lot of our fellow Americans.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a reasonable response. I think two things there. I think as a principle, I might weight the potential, assuming there's solid data to back this up. If data suggests that certain family arrangements are more or less conducive to the well-being of a child, I would weight that more heavily myself as compared to sort of the social stigma harm itself. But there's I think a more important, distinction that I want to draw. Like, I think there's the examples you talked about were particular gender roles within a heterosexual marriage or relationship, and then the question of same-sex parenting. In some senses, like those questions are less, I find them to be less important, and almost muddy the waters on how we think about a hierarchy, simply because, like, for example, with same-sex parents, my understanding, not an expert, but my understanding is that data is sort of inconclusive on well-being for children, largely because we just have, like, we don't have a lot of data. It's the adoption by same-sex parents or artificial insemination or what have you is just such a new thing socially that we don't have a ton of data. But in any case, as far as I can tell, and from what I understand, everybody would agree that two parents is better than one. So for me, the real question is, how do we hold up the prior question of two parents versus, I mean, two parents versus one, I guess. And like, can we make more forceful claims about that with an eye to the welfare of the child?
What's the value there? So let's say we make those claims really strong. Like what's the value there? And what's the outcome that we're seeking? Are we just seeking for more people to just grit their teeth and make it through marriage? Is the outcome here that we want to build into our curriculum at schools, emotional tools that will help, that evidence shows can help kids be more successful as married partners? Is the goal here to have certain financial incentives that like there are certain benefits that the government gives only to married families and kind of promotes? Like what's the goal there? Because I think almost everyone would agree with you until we figure out what's your goal there.
Well, I mean, I think the goal is easier. How you get there is hard. The goal is to have children raised by both parents. That's sort of self-evident to the point of being annoying. And you're right. I think everybody would agree in theory. To your more tactical questions, I mean, I think this is just a big, I don't know. You'd have to answer questions like, when a child is raised by a single parent, is that the outcome of divorce? Or is it more likely to be the child of an unwed mother from the get-go, where there was never a marriage in the first place? Those would have different, you would need to think about different responses to either of those things. But maybe more interesting, just like culturally, do we celebrate marriage? Is it just a tax thing? Like, is it just a legal thing and a tax thing that lets you join your bank accounts? Or is there, like, setting aside for a second the sacramental conception of marriage that you and I might hold based on our faith traditions, is there something, or is there a model of secular marriage that we can hold up that just seems deeply attractive to people? And I say that with the caveat that maybe there's just a whole bunch of people who really want to get married and can't for some other reason, financial, the ability to find a spouse. I don't know. This is a question mark area for me, but what do you think?
Before we get too far down the road of agreeing with each other, I do think it's worth highlighting something that, I think was elevated this summer or last summer, I guess now, during the movement for Black Lives. And it's interesting, BLM has taken this language off of their official pages, and I don't know why they chose to do that. They did this late 2020. Yeah. But before they removed that, they said this about the family, and I think it needs to be heard because it suggests that we don't all agree here, that there are some people who would say, hey, the nuclear family is not an ideal that we all agree is good for kids. So this was from BLM. They said, quote, we disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable, end quote. And so I love that because, I mean, they're wise enough to put boundaries around their statement there. They're not coming out and saying this is how all families in America should be. I think they're saying that within their movement, they believe that there is a family structure that breaks this paradigm of the two-parent household down and doesn't think that anything has been lost. And I think that's interesting. I mean, I don't know if there's, I don't know what to do with that because it doesn't seem to me that there's a ton of evidence that shows that that's actually good for kids. But from the primary voice speaking out, the voice of Black liberation in our country saying that, I think it demands to be listened to and looked at. I wish I had a more. I think all of us should just think about, like, okay, so if this is being shared as a really important idea within the Black community, does this speak for most Black people? Does this speak for only some Black people? I think those are good questions to ask. Yeah, I don't have an articulate way to tie a thread on this, but I think that's interesting.
No, it is interesting, and it has garnered a lot of attention from people who, you know, for good or suspect reasons, disagree with the aims of Black Lives Matter. That particular bullet on their website has been front and center of the critique of the organization. Yep. I mean, two things come up for me. If the claim is a normative one, that having both parents around is either just makes no difference or maybe not a good thing, then I mean, I couldn't disagree more forcefully. If the critique is a suggestion that the nuclear family just conceived only of mother and father raising children alone on an island, if the critique is that maybe we can do better and that surrounding that unit with a community, whether friends and neighbors or grandparents and aunts and uncles, that sort of community is good for families and good for children, then I think there's something actually interesting in that. And for those of us who are, you know, fortunate to have a fairly mobile life where we live in different cities and move around the country, that often leaves us disconnected from some of those wider webs. You know, like I never grew up around my cousins and my aunts and uncles because I lived in a different country. That is something that does take resources to do if you don't have an aunt or a grandparent to come by and watch the kids. So yeah, I don't really know what they mean by that statement. And it's not precisely worded enough to tell, but that's kind of my, there's a couple of thoughts for you.
Yeah. We may enter the realm where evidence is, and I don't know if I want to say this, but I will. There are realms, I think, where evidence is not always the best warrant in an argument, or there are arguments that aren't based in evidence. There are arguments that aren't won by evidence, and that may be what Black Lives Matter is saying. Like, there have been, and there will continue to be other ideals of the family than the American nuclear family. They're historically right about that. And I don't know if they're saying that, hey, our evidence shows us that breaking down and disrupting this norm is objectively good for eighth graders in terms of their suspension rates. But they might be saying, because we know that norm has not always been the norm and that it doesn't have to always be the norm, we are declaring ourselves a community that you know, welcomes and embraces the unique shape of the Black community, for example. And we started off in the pod saying the two-parent household in the Black community in modern-day America is not the norm for black families. And so if that's what they're saying, and they're saying this isn't an evidence-based argument, this is one that goes maybe to deeper principles, I'm always sympathetic to those kind of arguments, and I think there's something to be learned from them. And I don't think it's always right to respond to an argument like that with evidence. Just like there are certain claims that I make about my own religious faith that I don't think the point isn't to disprove them with evidence, because I'm not making an argument in that realm. Go. Do you want to push back on that?
But yeah, but these aren't claims about a religious faith. They are, you know, if it is a response to the reality of that community, a reality that I don't know very well, then that's one thing. But if it's a statement of principle that flies against the best evidence we have about what's good for children today, Then I don't think there's a whole lot to be lauded there, and you know, again, that one sentence isn't descriptive enough to say for me to understand exactly what they're trying to get at. But the latter of those two, if it's just like, we want to do something different, then that's fine. But I think then you can at least ask the question with data that says, like, is that a good thing? Like, is that a good thing for kids? And if that group is making claims about what a broader society should do that includes a larger set of people than just the community that they claim to speak for, then that's another question too. So, that would be my pushback.
That's good. So, hey, let me try to still make the progressive point here. And this is maybe a closing thought from me, and I'll pose it as a question. So, Thane, what does Blockbuster, Barnes and Noble, and churches that still use pipe organs, what do all three of those things have in common?
Oh man, I don't know, but I'm excited to hear the answer.
Those are all examples of institutions that struggled or in Blockbuster's case, went out of existence because they failed to evolve. And I think if there's a broader question here about how do we strengthen our institutions in the world of, you know, post-postmodernism and every man for himself, every person for themselves, there's no definition of gender. We want to break out of all of our religious institutions. No one identifies with their parties, whatever it might be. If we want to think about how do we strengthen institutions in that world, and in particular the institution of the family. The institutions that are strongest are the ones that evolve, right? So the best institution when it comes to providing us movies is Netflix. And it's because they did what Blockbuster did for a while, but then they evolved. They did something new. They responded to the signs of the times. And the same thing with Amazon in response to a changing way of thinking about how we provide people with books. And it's true with churches, right? Like Catholic churches are hemorrhaging people, while churches that are creating music that sounds like the music of today and are using social media and are not going up in front of people and in the same priestly garments we've been wearing for hundreds of years, those institutions are strong. And so I just think there's something about the institution of the family that may take a page from the other institutions that are evolving. So if that's true, then I guess the question I leave you and I leave with listeners is like, what does it look like for the institution of the family to evolve? And maybe a prior question is, do you agree that the strongest institutions are the ones that evolve? That's certainly counter to, I think, the wisdom of the Catholic Church, which you and I both know and love. But it is, I think, proving itself, at least now, to be the way in which institutions are strong and resilient. So what would that look like in the family? It might look like something closer to what Black Lives Matter says, right? Like something closer to saying, hey, we actually know that this family structure is best for kids. And yet we make room for all of these other different structures of the family, both socially and in terms of our policy, and we celebrate and uplift them together, as opposed to saying, you know, here's the hierarchy that we continue to hold to. It's still an evolving thought, but I do think that the strongest institutions are the ones that can change, the ones that are flexible and pliant and supple, to use some thesaurus words. And I will say, without staking my flag too sharply in any one point on what this means policy-wise, that I think that's better for the family, and I think it's better for Americans if we allow the institution of the family to evolve.
Beautifully said, Quentin, and I disagree with most of it.
Good, go.
I mean, I would first challenge the premise that the institutions that evolve are always the institutions that do better. I don't know that empirically to be true. It certainly would depend on how long of a time span you'd like to look at. I mean, Netflix and Blockbuster, that's a neat example, but that's a 10-year thing. although your point is well taken about some of the challenges that the Catholic Church
is, a great response.
Is having, it's also 2000 years old. So, you know, it's hanging in there. And as far as I understand it, and I wish I had data at my fingertips on this, but I remember hearing that some of the more Orthodox sort of subgroups within religion, both in Christianity and Judaism, are actually the ones that are showing some real life and growth. So if that's true, it's a counterexample. As to the family, you know, I think you could respond similarly that have other family structures been practiced with some success at various points in time in different parts of the world? Sure. Is a mother and father raising their biological children a novel concept? I think it's certainly not. I think we can go back a long, long way of that being consistent. So I think we need this tension, as we've talked about before on the pod, between a progressive impulse to keep the institution moving and responding to a changing world and a more conservative impulse that says generations of people who are wiser than we give them credit for thought that this was a pretty good way to do it. So we mess with that at our peril. Only time will tell who's right.
So can I give you one specific example?
Sure.
Because you decimated my point there. So I gotta come in, get one last word in. Maybe one way to think about evolution of this is thinking about how people who are very pro-family can allow a pro-family stance to evolve. So one of the things that continues to mystify me today is how some people who are very pro-family and pro-two-parent homes and want to promote that, think it's socially good, don't also promote loudly same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption, because that seems like a way of both promoting an ideal that has a history as old as humankind, and yet also making room, right? Making room for an evolution of that, and making room for more people who want to promote that ideal. Honestly, it's a way of like multiplying that ideal in my vision. And it's always mystified me why folks on the right, let's say, if I can just do a super broad generalization, and this wouldn't stand up to any close analysis, but a very broad generalization, people on the right should be saying things like, hey, we believe two-parent families are wonderful, and this is why we think same-sex marriage is such an addition to this. Now, I realize that goes against certain religious inclinations of a lot of those people, but I guess that's what I mean. It's like, it's not let's tear down the one thing that has been a part of human cultures forever, but let's make room for that ideal to be multiplied, for more people to get to express it and enjoy it, for more kids. You think about it, especially the kids that are welcomed into same-sex families, almost always it's kiddos like me who needed someone to adopt them, to be in a home, in a family, in a unit. So I guess I would offer that as maybe a more specific way of taking the ideal that I was sharing and trying to ground it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, that's a much better argument from my perspective, and I'm going to disappoint our listeners by agreeing with you to wrap up. I am certain that there are countless same-sex couples that would be as good or not better parents than many heterosexual couples, and there are so many kids who need a good place. I think it's also probably true that same-sex couples that have gone through the difficult process of getting married in our society today and are fighting through the difficulties in getting to adopt are probably self-selecting for people who really want to be good parents. So yeah, I mean, I think this is a yes and question. I think there's sort of a separate and more complicated question about how that plays into the right of a religious organization to make decisions about that. And I bring that up because there happens to be a Supreme Court case coming down in the next couple months about a Catholic adoption agency that is being sued because they do not place children in same-sex in the homes of same-sex parents. I think that's a more complicated issue. You know, in that case and in general, there are lots of adoption agencies that are not Catholic or otherwise religious. And yeah, I think that's a great response, Quentin, and a good place to look to expand. I mean, it's just about finding kids a good home, you know?
Yeah.
And for so many, the ship has sailed on them, unfortunately, growing up with their biological parents in a happy, stable marriage. Like, that is just not a reality for so many children. And there are lots of loving families out there that don't look like that. And I think there's space for both.
Well, that the Supreme Court case sounds like we should do an episode on that. That's, man, that's fraught. That's fascinating. Hey, thanks for a great conversation.
Thanks, Quentin. I enjoyed it.